Welcome to the 301st episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Chip Jacobs, author of the debut novel Arroyo. Stay tuned for the interview. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Chip Jacobs. Jacobs is the author of the new novel Arroyo. Jacobs' previous nonfiction books include As It Seems, The Impossible Life of Gordon Zoller, The People's Republic of Chemicals, and the international best-selling Smog Town, The Lung-Burning History of Pollution in Los Angeles, both with William J. Kelly, and The Ascension of Jerry. Chip Jacobs, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about Arroyo yet, how would you describe your new novel?
I would describe my novel as a historical look at Pasadena, California, best known for the Rose Bowl, Rose Parade, during the Progressive Age in America, 1913. Anything seemed possible. Electricity was just coming online. Electric typewriters. New medicines, automobiles, first and foremost. And my story is really about a young solar power inventor and a clairvoyant dog that are both drawn to this bridge that is just a representative and a welcome mat for the great city on the Arroyo Seco. And you know, what first seems like a miracle, this vaulting concrete that's going to allow motor cars to cross a dangerous ravine, becomes an object of politics, bad blood, and in the end, death and mystery.
And do you remember the original idea that led you to write Arroyo?
Absolutely. As a somewhat of a rambunctious teenager, I got into a car accident in the parking lot below the Colorado Street Bridge. And when I got out, and I had a rather checkered driving record by then, and when I got out to inspect the horror in the back of my parents' station wagon, I looked up, and this bridge and these kind of noirish fluted lamps and flyover pedestrian bays seemed to be looking down at me. And, you know, I later became a journalist. I wrote a freelance story about the construction accident that the city kind of has swept under the rug. And it just felt like a natural environment in which to write a story. Then when I looked around and found, oh my gosh, you know, not only was there excitement about the automobile age and these magical parts of Pasadena, but, you know, we had Teddy Roosevelt, Upton Sinclair, famous writers and astronomers around. So it was really a rich setting.
And were there things about Pasadena and the Colorado Street Bridge that surprised you that you discovered when you were doing your research for the novel?
There was. Because we've lived with cars all our lives, we don't appreciate at the dawn of the automobile age how hungry different parts of the economy and business people and companies and groups were to create an automobile industrial complex. And I mean, basically, even before the bridge was open to traffic in 1913, the Automobile Club of Southern California had already knocked signs into the hillside saying, New York, 2,700 miles to the east, downtown Los Angeles, 20 miles to the west. And so there was just this, kind of fever dream of a new way of life. Also, in terms of the bridge, you have to go down a little grade to drive it from Colorado Street or Colorado Boulevard, as we know today. That's where the Rose Parade runs. You know, millions of Americans hungover on New Year's Day, you know, see it. It was because of the influence of the wealthy that set up on what was called Millionaire's Row in Pasadena. They didn't want this sweeping, rounded bridge to block their view of the mountains. So just like today, you know, the affluent hold somewhat outsized power. And just like today, you know, there's always a hunger for a new industry.
And you're talking about the dawn of the automobile age, and you mentioned the signs that point the way to downtown Los Angeles or New York City. Obviously, you're in the greater Los Angeles area, and we're recording this during this pandemic. I'm curious, what has been the impact of the stay-at-home order in terms of the normal life of LA, which is behind the wheel?
I guess it's a sad irony that it takes a pandemic to make Los Angeles work again in terms of mobility. I recently drove out to Marina Del Rey, and which is on the coast. I'm inland in Pasadena, and what normally would be an hour and 15-minute drive took me 35 minutes. You can get around. You're not backed up at traffic lights. It's free-flowing. And as you know, Los Angeles has got the worst traffic in the United States. It has for decades. It's just been an epic failure. And this is very consistent with other disasters. And when I was a reporter, you'd always see the same thing. After 9/11, after an earthquake, after a riot, the freeways and roadways would be immaculate and freewheeling. And then as soon as the danger passed, the roadways are like nature. They just detest a vacuum, and they just became gridlock almost immediately.
Well, as you mentioned, you're a reporter, and you've written and published several nonfiction books. How was the transition for you to fiction with Arroyo?
I think because writing has always come easy to me. I moved into the fiction space with a pretty cocky attitude that I can do this. I'm as good as this person, or I can turn a phrase as well as that person. And it was a very humbling experience, Jeff. It took me probably 8 drafts to get the basic idea right, and then 500 hours of crafting and sculpting and erasing and rethinking things. Writing a novel is just a more intricate operation because you have to, take readers on an arc with characters that you don't have to worry about when you do nonfiction, because their actual life story leads you to where you want to go. This is like a wide open universe, and sometimes all that freedom can be actually very imprisoning, because you don't understand. You have a mission, which is to show your characters changing over time and not letting an exciting backdrop overtake the story. So it was by far the hardest writing assignment I've ever tackled.
And so what are your earliest memories of reading and books?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Nobody has asked me that. I remember very clearly as a little kid being on my bunk bed and reading things like The Three Musketeers, Robinson Crusoe, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Catcher in the Rye, one of my favorite all-time books. And of course, more, books geared to younger people like The Oxbow Incident, Things Fall Apart. I just absolutely adored books. And I was the youngest child of a rather dysfunctional childhood, and I was alone a lot of time. And so I would curl up with my beagle and a book and probably some, illicit chocolate I stole out of my mother's pantry, and would be there for hours.
And so what was the path to publication for you to get your first book published?
My very first book?
Book.
I would say my first, it required finding an agent. Having an idea. This is my smog book. Mm-hmm. Trying to understand where my book would fit and how it was going to stand out. And I remember back in like 2006, 2007, Amazon was not the robust website and juggernaut that it is today. And my fingers kind of timidly typed in the search engine, air pollution, smog. I mean, I'd grown up in a very air pollution Pasadena. So, I found there was no books on it. Well, we got an agent very quickly, but from then on, it's as a writer, you kind of hand over control, like a musician, to the company producing your work. And the agent I had was great, but he was older. He got sick. Things weren't so transparent. The editing process was by far the most chaotic I'd ever undergone, where I had multiple editors were editing chapters backwards, you know, instead of going chronologically in a linear way. It was tough. And then, of course, you know, I'm putting out the book with my co-writer in November 2008, which is probably the worst part of the Great Recession. And where we normally expect to be a bestseller, have packed rooms, you know, it didn't turn out that way. So it was a very sobering experience. Things changed, but, you know, you have to have a thick skin and an ability to accept rejection and curveballs to be an author.
Well, we discussed earlier the dawn of the automobile age and how this pandemic has changed the traffic patterns in the greater LA area. And, you know, you just mentioned your book on smog. I'm just curious, are you familiar with the work of James Howard Kunstler?
I don't think so.
He's a very outspoken opponent of sprawl and the American, you know, passion for gas guzzlers. And I was just curious where I mean, obviously, given the research and writing that you've done, where do you see, you know, traffic and automobiles headed in, you know, let's say Southern California? In the years ahead. I mean, obviously, you know, one thing that I would, you know, think would be an impact is the growth of electric vehicles, Tesla and others as well. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, there's a misperception. It's a very trenchant question. There is a misperception that Californians are Prius driving, granola munching, solar power consuming citizens. That's not true. You know, as I learned in our smog book, you know, it's a very passive environmentalism where people allow themselves to get taxed every which way so they can live with the irreconcilable conditions of clean air and, affordable cars or maybe even two-car households. Most projections, believe it or not, show car ownership is going to plunge in the future, maybe like by 90%. We're talking maybe a generation away because of the advent of self-driving cars, AI-driven traffic, where cars move in pods, and the explosion of people working from home. I read one story that said, you know, eventually you're going to get an ambulance at your house, a self-driven ambulance, like within 10 seconds. It just could because it's going to be using such advanced modeling and prediction. And Uber will be here not long after. So the car culture, which is so identified with LA, is going to undergo radical transformation. Electric cars, which you asked about, you know, that they only represent 2 or 3% of the roads and the cars in California. Most people have stuck with the traditional gas guzzlers. And you mentioned sprawl as well. You know, sprawl was sort of the branding of Southern California at the turn of the century when the Colorado Street Bridge was being built. You know, people looking for a different way of life than the tenements in New York or cramped together townhouses of Chicago, et cetera. You know, they wanted more freedom, more personal space, you know, sort of manifest destiny, have your own backyard. And places like Pasadena allowed that. And today, all that sprawl, all those freeways connecting people to suburbs and exurbs has come back to bite us. And we're trying to live more like New York these days, throwing up apartment buildings left and right. And in fact, you know, I tried to somewhat tease this into my book, Arroyo, you know, where my character in the first life is living in a landscape of Victorians and craftsman houses and bungalows and nothing very tall. He's coming back to a city that's building apartment buildings like they're going out of style. So, you know, all that's old is new again. And, you know, suburban sprawl, only works when freeways work, when there's job centers that don't make people drive for 2 hours. And now with climate change, I don't know if we can afford urban sprawl.
So what was your writing process like for Arroyo? You mentioned earlier the 8 drafts and what a challenge Yes. it was to make the shift from nonfiction to fiction. Did you outline the novel extensively before writing, or did you write more organically? What was that process like for you?
Well, you've heard of the fear of the blank screen, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I was, I almost like had PTSD towards it. I wrote a 30,000 word treatment of my book because I was so apprehensive about commencing it, writing that first word in that first chapter. My father died during the middle of the process. That threw me for a loop. You know, it's, having a very restless curiosity and probably a little ADD myself, you know, the internet and something you're interested in is only 5 seconds away. And I had to really kind of almost put like blinders, horse blinders on myself. After my when I saw my deadline looming, I hadn't got enough done. I didn't have a proper ending for my book. And it just, it took a lot of discipline. And so I normally would work, you know, in crunch time, 7 days a week from about 9 to 7. And I actually gave myself a medical condition pushing to it. I gave myself something called trigger finger, where you inflame a tendon in one of your digits, in this Ouch. Case, my thumb. I mean, I was hitting the space bar so much, you know, I could barely move my hand. But I'll tell you, it's working yourself to exhaustion where you really can have a lens inside of yourself and know what you're capable of.
So what writing advice would you offer for listeners who are writing their own stories or novels, or even someone who's working on a nonfiction book?
I would say first and foremost, write the book you would want to read. Writing and you know, literature, especially fiction, is so subjective. People have reacted to my book. Somebody, one reviewer said, it's a quirky tale you're either going to love or loathe. That's okay. It's okay to have people that are not on board. You just have to feel like what you wrote is something only you can do. You're happy to have it as your legacy. But you just have to stand firm inside of yourself and not look outside to reviewers. I would tell people, you know, to read in the genre they're hoping to write and outside their genre. Whatever they do, just always keep reading, whether it's toaster instructions, whether it's, you know, a gardening story in the New York Times, whether it's a pamphlet in a doctor's office. Your mind is like a sponge, and you can always see new ways of phrasing things and be open to new ideas. So you have to have a very fertile mind. I would also just tell you, if you're going to buy one book on writing, buy Stephen King's memoir, which lays out step-by-step advice about concentration, proper use of adverbs, the necessity for right grammar and taking risks. Those are the things I would tell you. You know, I mean, there's an old idea that I learned is true, which is once you're done with your first draft, put it away for a few weeks. Don't even think about it, and come back. And it's like being reborn in a, from a literature-wise way, because you will see holes in your story, you'll see the beauty in your story, but when you get too close to something, you're always going to miss peripheral vision. So, you know, have a process, write down goals, and whatever you do, you know, just know that your first draft is going to be kind of a piece of crap, to be honest with you. They all are, and that's the beginning to making something that's going to be a work of art eventually.
And so what books have you read recently that you enjoyed?
Well, I'm a big fan of Gillian Flynn, you know, Gone Girl, although I did like some of her other novels more. I absolutely adored All the Light You Can See, the Pulitzer-winning book. Right now, I'm getting ready to write a follow-up novel, which will be Pasadena-centric, but it's not going to be historical fiction. I'm reading the biography of a psychic named Edgar Cayce, who was absolutely a fascinating person, who was kind of a simple farm boy who did very poorly at school, and he had sort of a religious experience, spiritual experience, just like I did. But unlike me, he could sleep on a book and know its contents in the morning. Eventually, he trained himself to go into trances and, without any medical school or scientific knowledge, diagnose complex medical problems and prescribe holistic treatments that were just remarkably effective. He later became attuned to reincarnation, to understanding the journey of our souls. He really kind of was like a bumpkin of a Jesus. And I'm going to work him into my next novel because I always feel like, you know, readers want to learn something even inside fiction, and having true life historical fictions is really tantalizing.
And so where can people find you online if they'd like to learn more about you and your books and your new novel, Arroyo?
I'd say the best place is my website, chipjacobs.com. I have an Amazon page where you can learn more about my books. I'm on Twitter, and Facebook, although I'm not a giant consumer or advocate of social media. I just want to read and write stories, but it's a different age, as you know. So, you know, chipjacobs.com, people can see my reporting, my columns, read about my other books, and I do have a blog. And I just produced an essay about my experience as an 8-year-old boy when I got hit in the face with a baseball. And that night I had a visitor appear in my room. And it was the most personal, intimate story I've ever shared in my life. And it was part of the reason I wrote this book.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Chip Jacobs. Chip's novel Arroyo is available now, so go buy a copy. And Chip, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you so much. I had a blast.
Great.